Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up today, as we approach the 4th of July, we'll remind ourselves who came first. For instance, the native Indian who greeted the pilgrims by asking for a beer learned that phrase from English fishermen in Maine. But first, some news. A major U.S. military operation in Afghanistan is reportedly going well. Thousands of Marines fanned out across Afghanistan's dangerous Helmand province just after midnight local time. The operation called Strike of the Sword is the Marines' largest since 2004. That one was in Fallujah, Iraq. Rob Watson is the BBC's defense correspondent, keeping track of all of this in London. Rob, give us a sense of the magnitude of this operation and its goal.
Well, it's big. It's the biggest deployment of the U.S. reinforcements since President Obama announced his new counterinsurgency strategy for Afghanistan. It involves 4,000 United States Marines. These troops are there for many, many months, and you really won't be able to judge the result of this campaign, this operation, for a year or so, possibly as long as that.
Well, in fact, we understand that the Washington Post is reporting that the Marines were told by their commander, "We're not going to measure your success by the number of times your ammunition is resupplied. Our success will be very much predicated on restraint. You're going to drink a lot of tea. You're going to eat a lot of goat. You're going to get to know the people." The Marines are not going after the Taliban?
No, and of course this will be a bit of a change in approach for the U.S. Marines, who of course have the reputation for being very gung-ho. You talked about the last time the Marines have been deployed on such a scale was in Fallujah, and Iraq is relevant here. This is all about learning the lessons from Iraq. I mean, a lot of what's going to unfold now in Afghanistan, in southern Afghanistan and Helmand province, is from the Iraq playbook, if you like. And the great lesson of counterinsurgency that the United States military learned from that experience was it's all about protecting the people, not about killing the bad guys. So it's been very much emphasized to commanders and to their men on the ground in southern Afghanistan that this is about helping the Afghan people. How you'll measure the success of this operation is, I guess, whether the locals like you, and importantly, whether they're able to bring good governance and development to this very, very troubled part of Afghanistan, which is, after all, the very stronghold of the Taliban.
Well, we understand these combat troops are going to be accompanied by the largest ever civilian affairs contingent attached to a combat brigade. There's going to be 50 Marines with experience in local government and law enforcement. But how will the civilians embrace that? People coming in to tell them, you know, how to run their local government?
Well, I guess the answer is that's not what they'll try and do. What they'll try and do is to tease out what it is that the locals want. Now, of course, this won't be easy because, in my experience, when you approach the locals in Afghanistan, frequently what they'll say in southern Afghanistan when you have these tribal jurgas and the Brits or the Americans or whoever goes along and they say to the locals, well, what can we do to help you? And sometimes the response from the tribal elders comes back that, well, we want you to go and we want the Taliban to go. We just want to be left alone. I mean, I think that the Americans are going to have to make this point that, look, this isn't like some other NATO operations you've seen in the past where troops come in for a couple of days, they make a few promises, and then you never see them again. The point they're trying to make is, look, we're going to be here long term, so you don't need to sit on the fence. You really can trust us. Now, we'll have to wait and see. That's why I say it'll take a long time for this operation to be judged, whether Afghans do in fact decide to throw in their lot with the foreigners.
Well, and Rob, with your expertise, with the fact that you've been on the ground there, make another comparison, because in Iraq, large wads of cash were handed out across the country. We understand the thinking here is very different. They won't be handing out cash as much as you said, questions. You know, what do people need? But the Taliban can hire fighters for $5 a day, and people need that money. So what's your sense of how that approach will work?
Well, two things, really. First of all, of course, Iraq and Afghanistan are very different. Iraq is more predominantly an urban society, and so in many ways it was much easier for the United States and its allies to go in and offer money and projects. Afghanistan, certainly Helmand, is a very, very rural province. I think in terms of this issue of money and some Taliban fighters are only being there because they're getting paid, it's a job. I think that the US and its allies are acutely aware of perhaps the need to provide people who might be tempted to join the Taliban with something that's equally fulfilling.
Yeah. What about Afghan troop involvement? Hundreds of Afghan troops accompanied these 4,000 or so Marines, but the commander of the brigade says he wishes there were more, that Afghan troop support is imperative. Now, we're used to questioning Iraqi troop readiness. Your sense of Afghan troop readiness?
All of the allies fighting in Afghanistan are rather impressed with the Afghan National Army, but what it lacks is the kind of logistics, intelligence, aircraft, all the things that contribute to the United States and its allies being quite so mobile and so professional. So commanders would like a ratio of one Afghan amongst them for every 10 soldiers, just because of the great local knowledge and intuitive advantages that Afghans can bring to the operation.
That's Rob Watson, defense correspondent for the BBC, speaking to us from London. Rob, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, as we get ready to celebrate our country's birth, let's review. We know that Columbus discovered America, well, the outer Bahamas, in 1492, that pilgrims landed in Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1620. But what happened in between? And were Europeans here even before Columbus? Tony Horwitz asked that question and then dug in to find that more than 1,000 years ago, Vikings huddled in peat moss hobbit homes in the continent's northeast when they weren't fighting people they called Skraelings. That after Columbus, Spanish conquistadors read a document, a sort of early Miranda rights, to native peoples in the American Southwest before slaughtering them. Another Spanish commander slaughtered French Protestants in Florida, sparing those who converted to Catholicism and a few musicians to play for dancing. These are just a few of the details in Tony's book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World, about the 128 years between Columbus and the Pilgrims. It's now out in paperback. And we spoke with Tony last July 4th. He began his research after realizing how little he and other Americans knew of history. At Plymouth Rock here in Massachusetts, where the Pilgrims landed in 1620, a guide told him many visitors are confused.
People are bewildered by the 1620 that's etched on the rock. They say, why doesn't it say 1492? Isn't that when Columbus came? And many visitors think Columbus sailed here, dropped off the Pilgrims, and sailed home.
Yes, on the Mayflower, the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Maria,
exactly.
All at once. They're
yeah.
All in an armada. Well, that's just one of the details in your book. We also learned that Verrazzano had the first encounter with Native Americans 100 years before the Pilgrims did, when he went to the Carolinas. And then when he sailed north, Native Americans mooned him. He called their territory the land of bad people. He later changed it to Maine. As you're learning this history yourself, you are thinking what?
It's just strange the way we remember our history. It's almost as if we remember it in units from school, a unit on Columbus in 1492, and then we sort of leap ahead to the Pilgrims, and then
and that's the founding
fathers.
Right.
And these huge periods in between just end up being really blank. And certainly for me, that 1492 to 1620 period, I really knew almost nothing about what happened here at that time, and I think most Americans don't.
Well, for instance, that's why some are surprised to hear that when the Pilgrims landed, they were greeted by an Indian named Samoset, who spoke to them in English and asked for a beer, because others had come before. Now, tick us through.
Well, I begin the book with the Vikings, because while they never came to what's now the U.S., they did reach North America, what's now Newfoundland, 1,000 years ago. But the Spanish are really the first, beginning with Juan Ponce de Leon, and a series of conquistadors really rampage across half of the U.S. And at roughly the same time, you also have French, Italians not named Columbus, and others who are roaming not just the fringes, but all the way to central Kansas.
Well, let's go back to the Vikings just for a second, although some would say that's cheating. I mean, Newfoundland, really. I mean, that's not mainland USA, but still, 1,000 years before the Pilgrims, we learn that the first European, American continental birth might have been a Viking boy named Snorri.
Exactly. If Americans know that at all, they think of Virginia Dare, who's an English girl who's born in North Carolina in 1587. Well, turns out there was this Viking boy named Snorri who's born about 1,000 years ago, so almost 600 years before Virginia Dare.
Relatives of Leif Erikson were part of mm-hmm. this exploring, and this was a settlement that failed. Mm-hmm. Is that the story of the early explorers? They failed, obviously.
Yeah, the failure rate is huge. Really, it's a story of mistakes. the Vikings really stumble on the coast of America. Columbus thinks he's headed to Asia. Almost none of these explorers really find what they think they're going to find, but in the process of pursuing their myths and mistakes, they uncover huge parts of this world that was unknown to Europeans.
Well, let's talk about the Spanish conquistadors. You have De Coronado and others in the West. It was the first time natives and Caucasians saw each other, mm-hmm. and it was jarring.
Really what you have over and over again in this period is this experience we simply can't have today, first contact. Think about seeing a horse or a pig for the first time, as the natives did when the Spanish arrived. The Europeans, contrary to what we might think, tend to be shorter, smaller, less impressive physically than the Indians. So they're often kind of quite awed by these natives.
Some survived. You went to find the Zuni people? Mm-hmm. Tell us about them.
Yeah, the Zuni are remarkable to me because they're really hit by the very first wave of Spanish conquest in the Southwest. Coronado arrives in 1540, defeats them in battle. Yet they survive to this day on their own land, speaking their own language, practicing their traditional religion. And also they're descendants of Spanish families that settled there soon after in New Mexico. And needless to say, they remember this history very differently. And really still argue over it and even desecrate each other's monuments. So it's a little bit like Civil War memory in the South. It's something that's very real for people today.
Well, let's switch to Florida, where you also found communities in St. Augustine who debate what happened there, the slaughter of the Huguenots by the mm-hmm. Spanish.
When the Europeans weren't killing natives, they were often killing each other. The wars of religion in Europe spilled over to America. And when the French Huguenots or Protestants established a colony in Florida in the 1560s, the Spanish came and chased them out and massacred hundreds of them in this act really of religious violence. And again, still to this day, Protestants and Catholics in that part of Florida have sort of parallel ceremonies, either honoring what they view as the Protestant martyrs or as the Spanish Catholic conquerors.
You visited a Protestant church where the children reenact the slaughter of the Huguenots.
Right.
But you also met a man in Florida who made national news, by the way. He's the one who right. said St. Augustine had the first Thanksgiving, right. you know, long before the pilgrims did. And he defended Menendez and the Spanish in slaughtering the French. He said, well, he could hardly feed his own colony. How could he also have these French there?
Right.
So this is still going on. This is very living history for people.
It is, and often remembered in ways that are surprising. I mean, the ones who have embraced the French Protestants, for instance, are actually evangelicals, not of French descent, but they have started dragging crosses onto the park where that commemorates the site of the French fort and have really embraced these people from almost 500 years ago as sort of seminal Protestant martyrs on this continent. Mm-hmm. So it's always surprising to see how people remember this history.
Tony Horowitz, his book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World, is now out in paperback. It tells of the century between Columbus and the Pilgrims, which, as Tony was saying, is still contested. In El Paso, Texas, there's a statue honoring Spanish conqueror Juan de Onate, but Native Americans there remember him every year as the conqueror who cut off the feet of indigenous people. They want to erect a statue of a foot to mark the same history. We'll have more with Tony after a break. Also later today, the new energy secretary, a firm believer that man contributes to global warming. How will he fare in Washington? Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're reprising our conversation with author Tony Horowitz from last July 4th about a part of American history we often glide over, the 128 years between Columbus's sail and the Pilgrims' landing in Plymouth. Tony found that even things people think they know from that period, they don't. Pocahontas and John Smith in Jamestown, for example. She was just 10 when they met. And the story John Smith told about Pocahontas rescuing him, well, he may have lifted that from the documented account of Juan Ortiz, a Spanish castaway who was rescued by a native princess and wrote about it decades earlier. Tony told us about some of the other explorers we've now forgotten.
One of the most astonishing stories to me from this period is that of a man named Cabeza de Vaca, who's a Spaniard on a conquistador expedition to Florida that goes terribly wrong from the start. And he ends up being a castaway, taken in by coastal natives. and begins with three other men wandering the interior, being passed from tribe to tribe as celebrated medicine men. And over the course of 8 years, these men make it all the way from Florida to the Gulf of California before going into Mexico and returning to Spanish territory. Cabeza de Vaca writes a very riveting account of this ordeal, which to me is one of the great survival and adventure stories of all times.
And what year was this?
This was between 1528 and 1536. He and three other men, one of them a black slave named Estevanico, crossed the entire continent more than 260 years before Lewis and Clark. Yet I think it's fair to say that most Americans have never even heard of Cabeza de Vaca or of his companions.
Another Spanish explorer, Hernando de Soto, pillaged through the South. In what's now Tennessee, he and his men stayed with Indians, enjoying their hospitality. But you write, when the chief refused de Soto's request for 30 women, de Soto burned his fields, made 500 tribesmen his baggage carriers. Then there were the Mound people. These are thriving indigenous cities of mounds half a mile long. The people ultimately disappeared. Some mounds remain. You write Americans like Thomas Jefferson became fascinated with figuring out who built the mounds. They didn't think Indians could. Of course they did.
Yeah, it's not only the European history that's lost from this era. It's the native history. And one of the most astonishing aspects of that is what's known as the mound culture in the South and Mississippi Valley, where you had enormous, very settled, very sophisticated civilizations that existed right into the 1500s when the Spanish encountered them. And the remnants of those mounds still exist in Georgia and Alabama and other states. But again, it's this history that strangely we've almost forgotten.
Well, and forgotten also is that one of these cultures was ruled by a woman. Mm-hmm. And De Soto and his men carted the queen off.
Yeah, Hernando De Soto kidnapped. She's known as the Lady of Cofeta Cheki in what's now South Carolina, ruled this vast empire. And he carts her off as he marches west across the Appalachians. But she does manage to escape and flee home. So it's one of the few sort of happy endings in this chapter of De Soto, who's really a butcher.
And who dies a broken man. On the banks of the Mississippi.
Right.
There were other Spanish explorers who didn't see their role as just burning down Indian villages. Mm-hmm. For instance, one, when he came across Native Americans, told his men to sit down.
You know, I think we too often see the Spanish only in stereotype and sort of imagine they were all butchers. In fact, there were men of conscience who really did believe in treating the natives well. And there's one, Hernando de Alarcón, who goes up the Colorado River. And it's just obviously a very sensitive man. And yes, when he encounters Native Americans, orders his men to sit down and put their weapons down, and manages really through nonverbal contact to travel peacefully for hundreds of miles and have, again, this extraordinary experience of first contact, great detail about how they kind of communicated through hand signs and even crude sculptures, little stick sculptures. Mm-hmm. And he got quite a ways and back with no violence at all.
Some of the most stunning passages are about sheer discovery. You know, the Spanish explorers who are looking over into the Grand Canyon and trying to describe that, or going across the Great Plains and just like, well, there's a lot of grass here, you know. Just they couldn't even grasp it. It was that different a land.
Yeah. I think reading these accounts from this period really restores your sense of wonder at this continent. We're quite blasé about it. We live here. We've seen much of it. But when the Spaniards, for instance, first reached the plains, they've never seen anything like this. They ride for weeks and weeks and weeks across flat grassland with nothing but huge herds of buffalo, and they're just astonished by it, as are the Plains Indians by them. They'd never seen horses before, and suddenly these armored men arrive, you know, out of nowhere.
Perhaps attached to the horses.
Yeah, exactly. They seemed almost to be one, man and beast.
Columbus, again, has more things named after him in the U.S. than any of these explorers that, you know, mm-hmm. we've been talking about, who actually were on mainland America. You say he was sort of trapped in his own vision of what he wanted to find instead of having a blank slate of what might be.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
I certainly was taught that Columbus was sort of one of the first great moderns, a modern thinker who saw the world as it is and went out there and sort of defied the medieval myths about the world and made this great discovery. He was actually the opposite. He was more of a medieval mystic himself. He touches down at shores all across Latin America, Central, South America, the Caribbean, but the more he sees, the less he learns. He keeps thinking he's at the edge of Asia or he's near King Solomon's Mines. He gets kind of more mystic the further he goes along and really goes to his deathbed, one in disgrace, but also convinced that he's reached Asia.
So, Tony Hurwitz, your journey, retracing the steps and the history of America's early explorers, has resulted in the book, A Voyage Long and Strange, Rediscovering the New World. Today on the 4th of July, as we set off fireworks, we're celebrating conquistadors and the French Huguenots and some insane people in some cases, Native Americans. I mean, it's right. As somebody said, the country's roots are far more twisted than we know.
They're twisted and they go deeper. Particularly, I think, on July 4th, we're sort of reminded that we're a young country, the new world, but in fact, we're a lot older than we think. Speaking only of the European history here, it goes back 1,000 years in North America and a good 500 years here in what's now the U.S., and I think it's important to remember all those tangled roots, as you called them.
Tony, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Tony Hurwitz, again, his book, A Voyage Long and Strange, now out in paperback. And we're going to get out of the Wayback Machine and come back with the latest news in 1 minute, here and now. It's that time again for lovers of tennis to park ourselves in front of the TV with strawberries and cream. Yes, this weekend the Wimbledon champions will be crowned in, of course, Wimbledon, England. Will it be Swiss star Roger Federer's chance to win his 15th Grand Slam title and stand alone at the top of men's tennis, what with Rafael Nadal sitting down, nursing his knee? Here to talk about that and all the rest of the news from the world of sports, only a game host, Bill Littlefield. Bill, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Do you go with the cherries and the strawberries?
Strawberries?
No.
An adult beverage also is nice while you're watching sports on TV.
Well, let's start by the way we do every year by saying we know the women are playing today and we're not going to talk about it. So no lunging for the radio. We're not going to give it away. The men's semifinals will be played tomorrow. Let's start with Andy versus Andy. American Andy Roddick meets
right.
The sentimental favorite Andy Murray, looking to become the first British man in over 70 years to win Wimbledon.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, Andy Roddick recently started a new conditioning routine. He's infamous for his conditioning already, of course, and now he's playing brilliantly. Andy Murray has a lot of pressure on him because Queen Elizabeth said a while back that she would be at Wimbledon and would present the winner's trophy. And so I don't think he can stand up under that pressure. I'm not sure anybody could, so I go with Andy Roddick.
Maybe they think that that's inspiration for him, though. In the other semifinals, we said Roger Federer, chance to win his 15th Grand Slam, which would break the record of 14 he currently shares with retired Pete Sampras. He meets German Tommy Haas, who's long lived in the U.S., but he's German. Your thoughts there?
Federer.
I know.
Simple thought.
There's not a lot of tension there, is there?
The tension disappeared, as far as I'm concerned, when Nadal announced that he wouldn't be able to play.
Even though, Nadal won Wimbledon last year, but this is Federer's to lose, isn't it? Wimbledon has always been his court.
Absolutely.
Well, so there might be the drama if something doesn't go well there, and so we'll leave it at that. This Saturday, Tour de France begins in Monaco and Mondu. Already, a Dutch cyclist already has been barred for testing positive.
I don't mean to laugh at this, but
no.
Cycling fans celebrate the fact that their sport tests more frequently than any other. But of course, the downside of that is they keep catching people.
I know.
They keep cheating.
Well, and a lot of people are going to be watching American cyclist Lance Armstrong, the 7-time tour champion, returning from retirement. I want to play a little bit of an ad that he's done for Nike. Now, it shows scenes of cancer survivors interspersed with shots of Lance Armstrong riding. We remember he is, of course, a cancer surviving. Here's what he's saying. We'll hear a little.
The critics say I'm arrogant. A doper. Washed up. A fraud.
Boy, way to front load some of the criticisms. He goes on to say, I'm not writing for those critics, implying that he's writing for the cancer survivors. Of course, he's writing for Nike.
Right, exactly. Lance Armstrong's foundation has raised a lot of money for the fight against cancer, and he is also paid a lot of money by Nike. And it's a complicated world, isn't it?
It is, but, you know, what about these, you know, he's putting right out front that these allegations dog him, you know, that he has doped. Mm-hmm. What does he have to do in this race? He can't possibly think he's going to win.
I think he can possibly think really? He's going to win. Absolutely. Initially, when he announced that he would ride, he was presented as a supporting rider for Contador, who won the race. He's on the same team.
This is Alberto Contador, yeah.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Contador won last year. Now, all of a sudden, he's a primary rider. By the time the race goes off, I think Lance will be thinking very much in terms of winning the race.
Okay.
It's also the same race director, team director, as was the Brunel, who was the team director when Lance won all his other
But
Tour
doesn't that get complicated if Contador expects him to be, you know, giving him some wind? And
Contador sticking his foot into Lance's spokes as he goes by, that sort of thing. They'll make for a very entertaining Tour de France, I think.
Okay, real quick, we have a few seconds. So, of course, it being you, we have to acknowledge soccer. We couldn't leave without a tip of the hat to the U.S. men's soccer team. They took second in the Confederations Cup this past weekend, upsetting Spain in the semifinal. Led Brazil for a half. Do you think they will finally get the respect they deserve?
I think that there will be more interest in the World Cup next year than there would have been if the U.S. had flamed out before the semifinals in the Confederations Cup. And I think that's a good thing. I'm for more interest.
Good. That means you'll be joined by at least five other people.
Oh,
I'm kidding.
Millions.
I'm kidding.
Millions.
I'm kidding. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. You've got to catch it on the weekend. Bill, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
Back in a minute with thoughts on President Obama's new energy secretary, Here and Now. Next week, the Senate is expected to begin hearings on the climate change legislation that narrowly passed the House last week, the first legislation ever to deal with global warming. The bill's centerpiece is a cap-and-trade program that sets a ceiling on the emission of greenhouse gases, but also allows polluting industries to trade emission credits to meet that ceiling. Among those testifying will be new Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, President Obama's point man in the battle against global warming. He's the first cabinet member with a Nobel Prize. But as journalist Jeff Goodell asks in Rolling Stone, will that help Chu navigate the tricky shoals of Congress and Washington's lobbyists? You might remember our conversation with Jeff about his book, Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. We'll link you to it at our website. Well, he's back now with a look at the new guy at energy. Jeff, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So Stephen Chu has the president's ear on global warming, and he's also spoken quite a bit about it. He's testified before Congress, and he's been pretty frank. What is he saying?
Well, you know, it's pretty remarkable the kind of frankness with which he's been talking about the dangers that we face with global warming. You know, he talked about drought in the Southwest, the possible end of agriculture in California. He's talking about increased hurricane activity, things, you know, we have not certainly heard from, you know, cabinet members in Washington ever before. And he's really out front in articulating these sort of dangers that we face if we don't do something about greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, you relate one telling anecdote when Chu was speaking to elite scientists at MIT and was asked for his views on geoengineering. This is the concept of spraying particles into the atmosphere to deflect sunlight in the event that attempts at lowering global warming aren't enough. Very futuristic thinking. Why is that question, you know, his opinion on geoengineering, so loaded? And what did he say?
A lot of environmentalists think this idea of geoengineering is really a kind of nightmare. One of them called it the Frankenplanet solution. It's really a taboo subject. But it did come up at this MIT meeting that I was at, and it was really interesting because he said, look, we need to be studying this geoengineering. And more importantly, you know, he talked about the targets for carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere. And one of the sort of benchmarks for dangerous change is 450 parts per million in the atmosphere. And that's what most scientists say, we need to keep it below that. And he just frankly said, we're not going to make that. So we need to think about Plan B. And that was a startling thing to hear from a cabinet member.
You say the room went quiet for a minute. Well, and you also say that big coal may be his biggest obstacle towards some of his goals of turning to biofuels other than fossil fuels. Now, obviously, you're no fan of the coal industry. We know that from your book. But we also know that President Obama is from a coal state, and people in the energy business say coal is the answer to global warming, that it makes more sense to retrofit existing coal-burning plants to capture carbon dioxide emissions than stop using coal altogether. And we know that Chu has really been pushing towards biofuels. So how is he going to navigate this particular shoal?
Chu has had a very difficult time with this. Before he became energy secretary, he made a number of speeches where he really laid out the dangers of continuing to burn coal and how difficult it will be to meet these emissions limits if we continue to burn coal. But then now, since he's taken over at the Department of Energy, he's sort of backtracked on a lot of that. A lot of money right now is flowing toward this idea of being able to capture and store carbon dioxide from coal plants, technological solutions to allow us to keep burning coal. But it's very problematic, and if we can't get it to work, there's no chance of us meeting these targets.
Well, let's learn a little more about Chu, Steve Chu. We know that his parents fled China in the late 30s when the Japanese invaded. They both went to MIT. He went to UC Berkeley, worked at Bell Labs. He had a breakthrough there in quantum physics that led to his Nobel Prize. And also then was a director at one of the Department of Energy's labs, the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. But where does he think energy should come from?
At Lawrence Berkeley Lab, he looked into biofuels. He did a lot of work on genetic engineering of various enzymes to create biofuels to replace gasoline. He's very interested in solar technology. They're doing a lot of research there on what's called nanosolar, allow you to make very thin photovoltaic cells that can be kind of printed like newspaper almost and kind of rolled out and very cheap and very simple. The thing that really makes him different than anyone that's ever held this position before is that he really truly comes out of the Silicon Valley culture of, you know, we can solve these problems through innovation. He's trying to turn the Department of Energy into something like the old Bell Labs, which invented many things that changed our lives, like the transistor, which led to the computer age and all that kind of a thing.
Well, he also has his critics because of his faith in technology. First of all, he was the guy at Lawrence Berkeley who engineered a deal with the British oil company BP that brought billions to that lab to focus on things like bioengineered crops, which was brilliant to some and is considered a deal with the devil, you know, to others, as you write. And there are those who say he doesn't want to deal with the small things individuals can do to curb global warming, driving less. You spoke with one of his critics, Tad Patzek. What did he say?
Well, I mean, the criticism that many people have of Steve Chu and that Professor Patzek had is simply that he's very interested in all this advanced technology that is very kind of fun to think about and very sexy. You can certainly argue that as the Secretary of Energy, that's what he should be thinking about, and it's really up to President Obama and others to think about the broader picture.
But how well is he going to function in the Department of Energy? You describe a DOE that's sort of an entombed Cold War-era bureaucracy. You expect to see Dr. Strangelove, you know, come out of the revolving door. They've got this money from the government now, stimulus package money that has to be doled out by September of 2010, but they can't seem to get loans out because the loans themselves are 1,000 pages long. Just the worst of Washington bureaucracy, and their major concern for decades has been taking care of nuclear waste. So how does he work from within that building?
One of the interesting things that he's doing is he's sort of spinning off something called ARPA-E, which is a small research lab that he's going to focus a lot of the money and attention on.
It's sort of a brain trust of clean tech wizards. You write the DOE equivalent of Steve Jobs' garage.
A lot of the rules that govern the DOE about procurement and about hiring and firing and all that are going to be waived. But it's a big job.
How shocking is it to the whole energy system to have a guy like this come in who actually stands up and says, gee, I'm not sure we're going to make our targets for curbing global warming, as opposed to, in recent memory, people debating about whether global warming even existed or if man had anything to do with it?
One of the things that the Nobel gives Steve Chu is a kind of independence and a kind of authority to say things, and I don't think he feels as constrained by the political system as certainly other energy secretaries have. And, you know, I think the big question will be is how much of this will be tolerated by the administration. I mean, to what degree will they allow him to keep speaking out bluntly about the dangers of global warming, and will they essentially try to keep him quiet?
That's journalist Jeff Goodell. His profile of the new energy secretary, Stephen Chu, appears in the new Rolling Stone. Jeff, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back.
I know I got a bad reputation, and it isn't just talk, talk, talk.
That guy with a bad reputation is back. It's been about 8 years since Freddie Johnston's last offering of original music. Here's a little reminder of the songs that had critics calling him the songwriter's songwriter.
The lover.
And now Freddie Johnston is currently on tour promoting his new CD, Rain on the City, and he's kind enough to stop by our studios once you found them wandering around the city. Freddie, welcome. Thanks so much for coming in. And how are you?
I'm great.
Now that you're here.
Now that I found the CVS.
Yeah, we're across from the CVS. But I ask how are you because on at least two tracks on your new CD is the word lonely. Lonely Penny has you commiserating with an abandoned penny that you found on the sidewalk, and Don't Fall in Love with a Lonely Girl. You're lamenting a relationship you can't seem to end with a girl who wants everyone's attention but yours. Is there a reason why the word lonely works in, or is it just a good songwriter's device?
It's just a good word.
Let's listen.
You know I wake up, it's first light. Sleeping in my chair all night. Just then, on time, she walks in like everything's fine. Don't fall in love with a lonely girl, 'cause you'll never be alone with her. Don't give your heart to a lonely one, 'cause you'll always wonder where she's gone. Don't
chronicling the lives of lonely, unlucky souls has been one of your trademarks. Is that also just because it makes for good songwriting, or?
You know, I wish I could tell you the truth. You know, I won't be flippant about it, but the songs are the songs.
The songs are the songs.
Yeah, but I didn't live through the autobiographically, the Don't Fall in Love with a Lonely Girl at all. But I'm sure that any of my friends would say that the song came from somewhere, if it's not about me.
But is there a genre that maybe you really fit into nicely and some people are very proud to be in, which is the songwriter that could have been a far bigger household name if they had written songs according to formula? New York Times critic Robert Christou called your 1992 release, Can You Fly, a perfect album. 2 years later, you put out This Perfect World. Rolling Stone named you Singer-Songwriter of the Year. And Elektra, your record company at the time, tried to push you towards that, hey, here are the kinds of songs that could get you in the top 40. And the way we read it, you didn't want to go there.
Well, I don't know. That's really kind of not for me.
Is that how you'd write that? Is that how you'd...
No, I'd probably write it more cynically. But I can't write my own bio. Yeah, everybody's going to say, oh, that's that guy that, you know, in 94, he had his biggest hit. But the real story is that, hey, I'm still here. I'm not grousing about it. And I'm really, you know, we just heard three songs from three different eras of my career. And as far as I can hear, the new one sounds a heck of a lot better.
Well, let's listen to another one of the new ones. This is Venus Is Her Name. It's a song about a bittersweet reunion of old lovers.
But when we walked along in the falling rain, you know it's been so long, but it feels the same. You're still my girl.
Freddie Johnston, remind us where you come from. Kinsley, Kansas, you say, so in the middle of nowhere, you had to get a mail-order guitar, farmland. In fact, is it true that to finance one of your early albums, you sold off part of the farm that had been in the family for generations?
Well, yes, it is true. That is my story, and I don't want to hide from it or make light of it or, you know, minimize it. But the only money I had is what I inherited. And, you know, my parents are dead, but she found out about that during an interview.
Who did your mom?
My mother, you know. I didn't want to tell her, and so I never told her. So it's not, you know, it's not like some cut and dried thing, man. You know,
it was emotional.
Well, I did it like I was completely the most complete and utter, you know, profligate idiot, you know. And so luckily it turned out.
It turned out okay. Yeah, well... Yeah. And you're now a guy who maybe had farmland in your ancestry, but now your music...
Now I have music in my ancestry, right? So I'll give my kid a guitar instead of farmland, and if he sells it, then...
Then you'll see how you feel.
I'll see how I feel, exactly. You sold that guitar.
But your music pays homage to urban life. You know, it feels like, when we listen, it feels like a man walking the streets, looking over, pausing on a bridge,
Well, yeah. I'm definitely the guy who romanticized the city and moved to New York, and it became my magical, mythical place. And that's why Perfect World and Can You Fly Too,
and
a lot of urban images, you know.
I'm thinking of a guy sitting in a train station saying goodbye to someone as you do in the track Central Station. Let's listen.
On the ceiling of Central Station, not far wishing those constellations, tired stone, forgotten glass, weary wood, and faded brass. I'm bound back home, and you can't go when I'll be back. I don't know.
Is that Grand Central in New York, or just
it was
any?
Actually Central Station in Amsterdam, Holland. And the song was set in Holland, but of course it refers to these. I'm being confusing here.
No, the beautiful, is the renovated Grand Central Station in Manhattan that has this gorgeous atrium.
Yeah, Grand Central Station has I don't know how many of the constellations, but they are in the ceiling in electric lights.
Right.
And so that's the image in the song.
But the story's...
The story kind of came from Holland, you know, it was a story that a friend told me. Sometimes that does happen.
Well, let's talk about another song that, you know, happened. The title track on the new CD, Rain on the City. We understand this song happened by accident?
Kind of did. I bought a guitar for my niece, who was 4 at the time. I tuned it up for her, and then she'd taken the 4th from the top, the G string, and tuned it down half a step without me knowing. I guess she was, like, standing there just playing with it.
Yeah.
And I picked it up, and bling, and I don't know exactly what it creates, but it created that's where the song came from immediately. I've always thought of it as somewhat magical, though I don't believe in that kind of stuff. It was just amazing. The whole melody came out right then. I've always been very happy about that story because it actually happened. You know, a little kid messed with my guitar and created a song.
Let's listen to Rain on the City.
We will all come down a peaceful sound and rise up with the sun. We will gather there up in the air and fly over everyone. We collide and change and fall again on some city day. Somebody wash something away.
So, Freddie Johnson, you should, you know, like, hand out your guitars to 4-year-olds more.
You are so right, Robin. In fact, I'm going to do that at every show, I think. There'll be a sort of help Freddie write a song session after the gig, so all the kids could just go in there and mess with my tunings and all this, and I'll see what happens.
Magic. That's Freddie Johnson. His new CD is Rain on the City. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Freddie, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.